You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast. Number
166, Flat World, interview with Alastair Adam. Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back. That little teaser was part of a song called Mine Again from the album Passion Leaves a Trace by Black Lab. I played one of their songs last month, and I really liked the group. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll play the full song at the end of my podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Inside Higher Ed, the online source for news, opinion, and jobs for all of higher education. I also invite you to follow me on Twitter. My handle is RodsPods. As always, I post links to all the things we talk about on my show notes at www.rodspulsepodcast.com. In this episode, I'll be interviewing Alastair Adam. He's the co-CEO of Flat World. Flat World is a digital-first college textbook publisher that's building a niche between the high-cost traditional publishers and open education resource, OER, publishers. I learned a lot about their business. We answer the question, what is the background of Flat World? How many titles do they have? How many faculty are using their books? How are authors recruited? What formats are available? How much does a typical textbook cost, electronic and print? How much do the authors earn? LMS support? And some of their special features. I really like the fact that they offer the first three chapters of a textbook for free electronically so that there's no problem in students getting the textbook in time at the beginning of a course if they're late to purchase it. So learn all about Flat World from Alastair Adam. Without further ado, here's my interview. Alastair, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today and my listeners.
Well, Rod, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
I understand you're traveling, and I appreciate your taking the time out. Before I get into the nitty-gritty of Flat World and learn all about your company and your product, why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself and how you got involved with Flat World?
As you mentioned, I'm co-CEO of Flat World, which we'll get into, but we're a high-quality, low-cost disruptor in the college textbook market. And I came to this, I first started life in investment banking and then followed my now wife to Boston 20 years ago this summer. I started in a role in a consulting firm. And then worked actually on my very first project in the college textbook space with my co-CEO, John Eielson. So we've been working together for 20 years. We left that firm to start our own consulting firm focused on the information and publishing industry back in 2002. And we spent the next 14, 15 years working with clients in the space to help them really focus on growth strategy. And that included working with nearly all of the large U.S. college textbook publishers. We sold that business back in 2014, and at that point, we're in a position to pursue a hypothesis that we had, which was to disrupt this market that we had watched over the years with ever-increasing prices and ever-slowing unit sales, and to do something a little bit different. And We signed a couple of authors, and then we had an opportunity to acquire the Flat World business as a way to really accelerate what we were trying to do. So that's how we ended up at Flat World.
I see. So Flat World did exist before you took it over. What was it in the same business, or you changed it? How did that get started, Flat World?
So there were two very enterprising characters, Jeff Shelstead and Eric Frank, who came out of Pearson. They worked for Pearson. They left Pearson back in 2007 with this similar idea, to disrupt the to do things differently in the college textbook space. And they took on quite a lot of venture money over several rounds and several years. signed some tremendous authors, got some high-quality authors in the traditional way, and built a great platform, you know, lots of other wonderful attributes. But they had an economic model which was to give away the digital version of the textbook under a Creative Commons license and then try and drive revenue through selling print and ancillary and so on. And my co-CEO, John, describes that as it's a little bit like running a student bar where you give away bottles of beer and you try and make money selling glasses. at some point. So they did that. They then, the venture backers decided to pivot. And in 2012, they actually put up a paywall. They moved from free to fair pricing, but they put sort of time and energy into building out a competency-based learning platform. They actually changed the leadership. Jeff and Eric left. I think it was at that point, brought in new leadership. And they really took the legacy textbook business, the bit that we ended up acquiring, and they largely ran that for cash to help fund the competency-based learning platform. So, yeah, they were in the same business, but they had a slightly different business model, but they had some wonderful assets in terms of high-quality content and titles and some traction.
Well, this is very, very interesting to me and timely. I mean, in higher education, as you know, we're seeing a lot of pressure because of student demographics, and we're competing for a dwindling population of high school students. And
right.
We're trying to squeeze expenses wherever we can. So the idea of an open education resource or something like what you're talking about with your, you know, online textbooks and having different options for students is very attractive. So tell me a little bit about the product itself. You know, I'd be interested to know, for example, how many titles you have. Do you specialize in any particular subject area? You know, who's your main market?
Sure. And let me talk to that. Let me just touch on your previous point, if I may, about the market and what's happening. Because I agree with you. You know, I think a little bit, though, it tends to be sort of framed in this, in terms of this dichotomy between the, you know, the really high price for new textbook from the kind of traditional incumbents. And, you know, as prices have gone up and up and up over certainly the 25 years that I've been in and around this space, and sell through, you know, the percentage of students actually buying a new textbook is down in the teens now. And it tends to get framed either that on the one side or the sort of the OER model on the other. And I think what we would suggest is that there's actually a middle way. You know, you need to reward authors for their contribution. You need to keep content fresh. You need to make sure that it has the full range of instructor supplements and things to help the professor. So, you know, often we read these articles the whole time. It's sort of either one or the other, but we're saying actually there's a low cost, affordable, sustainable model here as well. But to your question about titles, we're at about 150 titles now. So, you know, those are the full sort of peer reviewed, high quality textbook titles. They're focused more on the entry-level courses because that tends to be a bigger space. You know, there's more people doing Calculus 1 than Calculus 3. And we're looking to grow that at, you know, 25 titles a year or more. We're looking to rapidly expand it. If it had been us, and I think, you know, maybe if you were to talk to Jeff Shellstead or some others, they might have done this without necessarily some of the sort of external pressure. So there's some things I'd read. We would have concentrated the list a little bit more because there's a sales efficiency to that. If I walk down the business or finance department corridor and I bump into a professor, I want to have a book to offer them, right, for that interaction. And they went broad with their list perhaps a little bit quicker than we would have done. But we have a relatively broad list. We have beachheads very strong in business and finance, in social and psych, and, you know, and these other areas. But we're looking to add and expand that roster and that list, you know, as much as we can.
How do you find authors? Do you recruit them? Do they come to you, or...?
Our very first author actually was before we acquired Flatwell. Our first author was John Taylor out of Stanford, and his co-author, Akila Wirapana at Wellesley. John was, you may have be familiar with him. He was the runner-up to succeed Janet Yellen at the Fed, wonderful economist at Stanford with a great book. He had had that book published by another publisher. He'd actually been telling his students that they shouldn't be buying his book. It was too expensive. He and Akilah had got the rights to that book back. And we approached them. We noticed their book was no longer, being published, and said, "Hey, would you be interested in publishing with Flat World?" And they jumped on board. And so, we're always on the lookout for authors, who have an established book. I think theirs was in the 7th edition. We published the 8th edition of Micro and Macroeconomics. So we're always looking for those. It's quicker, frankly, to get those to market. But we're commissioning new authors as well. And that takes a little bit longer. It takes 2 or 3 years to get a new book into the market, get it fully peer reviewed, and get all the answering materials up to speed, homework developed, and so on.
Interesting. We may have a textbook here we should be talking to you about that's been out of print. So
let's talk. We'd be interested. We're always looking. We have Sean Wakely, actually, who's been in this industry a long, long time. People may have known him from sort of Alan Bacon and Cengage days and so on. And he's our head of editorial. Terrific guy. And always out there talking to folks and interested. So whether it's you or any of your listeners, please be in touch.
You know, I've been a techie all my life. I've been in this business for decades, more than I like to admit. But I think I'm unusual in that I don't like paper. I don't take notes on paper. It gets lost, misplaced. I'm almost 100% online, and that goes. I mean, I might have a print subscription to a magazine, but I'll read it on my iPad. So I'm very interested in your electronic formats for your books. You know, is it a proprietary format? Is it compatible with iPads, with Kindle? What's that like?
So, and we were lucky to inherit a great, as I say, publishing platform. And let me just start by saying that I'm format agnostic, right? I think that should be a decision for the instructor and for the student as to what they prefer. And the reason for that is that it varies based on circumstance. It varies based on the material. I may be much happier doing a math problem online, but if I'm reading a sort of a dense, text-heavy American history book, I may prefer to study at home on the couch with a highlighter, right? I may absorb from a print material better for that circumstance. But I also want the feature functionality set that comes with online. I want the videos. I want the linking, the searchability, the portability. But we don't want to dictate that. And for a long time, the industry has frankly been driving with this big push to digital, not because of customer demand, but basically as a way to disrupt the used book market. I mean, I go back 20 years and conversations about, we got to really push this ebook thing because that'll kill the used book market. And that's not the right way of thinking about it. You should be led by the customer and what they want. So we start with a digital offering at $29.95 for most of our books, right? Because you need those components. You need it for homework and so on. But if a student wants a companion print product, we'll sell it for not much more than cost. We try and keep it as close to cost as we can. We print those on demand largely. And four-color bound book is $25 in addition to that. Or if you want a downloadable in EPUB or PDF or .mobi, we really try and cover all formats so it's compatible with as many devices, mobile and so on, as possible, because we don't want to be dictating what the customer should do. Now, I will tell you that if you look at our data, we actually just did some survey work with our adopting professors. You know, some crazy number, 95% of them, I think, want to sample our product in print. But if you look at our actual consumption by students, I think our print attach rate is probably around 15%.
How about that? Yeah.
So there's a difference between the two, right? The professor makes the adoption decision based on print. The student tends to be more digital, more comfortable with the digital offering.
Right. Now, for the electronic offering again, I'm sorry, did you say it was like an EPUB format, or is it a specialized format for Kindle or iPad?
So it's kind of all the above, really. If you come onto our website, our base offering is served up HTML. So it's a web-based with a reader, with our own reader and so on the web, which is accessible either through a regular browser or on a mobile device. If you want to download the copy. We have that as an option, and that we so nearly all of our books are in PDF, which is actually the most popular, EPUB, or .mobi. So that it's compatible with, as I say, a wide range of devices there. Again, based on the download numbers, because we looked at this, not super popular. And again, I would have predicted with the sort of feature functionality of EPUB that might be the leader. But actually, by far and away, PDF is the most popular format.
We've experimented now and again with using iPads here on campus. So we've never been able to foot the bill to give all of our students iPads. But it's certainly very popular, especially in some of our programs. And, you know, with our iBook author, you can come up with some wonderful, you know, interactive books in that platform. But, of course, it's not platform agnostic. It's strictly iOS. Do you have any, is there any pressure for schools that are heavy into Apple devices to do that? Is that something that you're considering?
No, we have had the sort of discussion, should we have an app or, what's the experience versus the browser? And I think, you know, you're moving, and this has moved even in the last few years. There is less of a desire or a demand to download content onto a device. I think as bandwidth, as ubiquity of connection through Wi-Fi on campus and so on has improved dramatically, and as I think the browser-based reader experience has got better and better, and there's, you know, just there isn't that lag, that we definitely see the numbers for downloads dropping. And the most popular actually is just direct web access. But it, you know, has to be a good experience. It has to be mobile-friendly.
But you've bypassed creating a specific app, so these are basically web apps?
Yeah, so if you for web apps is for the core, and then again the PDF or the EPUB or whatever, most people have readers that they prefer on their device that they can use for those if they want to sort of download. But it's diminishing popularity. And we had this debate actually about to what extent is that going away altogether? You know, what about if you're commuting and you don't have good connectivity or whatever? But again, we just look at the data and say, well, what's happening? We're not trying to push it one way or another.
What's the typical process like for an author? How long does it take? How much do they have to do? Do they provide you with, I was going to say, camera-ready copy, but
I wish.
How does it work? What's the typical process?
I'm going to give you that old former consultant answer. It depends. We have some authors will come to us with the electronic files, and that makes life obviously a lot easier. You still have to go through your traditional publishing process in terms of your permissions and making sure you have image rights and all of those good things. But some will come to us with a sort of a PDF manuscript, and we'll have to then sort of recreate that. But our authoring is done predominantly in our proprietary authoring platform, Scholar. And so the authors effectively can write in that. Now, they can also write if they prefer in Word and give us a Word manuscript, and we'll port it across, and then future edits will be in there. Because we then save that to our server, and then from there it renders out, whether it's in HTML or PDF or multiple formats. So we have a sort of standardized template with a number of elements. One of the things we've done to drive speed to market, to get things into the market more rapidly, to take inefficiency out of the process, is some level of standardization. And so if you look at the layout of our books, pick up one of our print books or even online and look through it, you'll see a consistent look and feel to it. Now, that clearly has to accommodate everything from sort of math through marketing. But our cover design, for the life of me, I don't know why books have multiple trim sizes, lots of sort of time and energy into cover design that frankly doesn't add a whole lot of value to the student. And part of that is legacy, as these companies have come together through acquisition over the years. It's very hard to then go back and unwind that. But with the luxury of starting with a sort of a clean sheet of paper, so to speak, we have had a greater level of standardization, which reduces overhead. And they're things that are not valued by the customer.
Now we come to the nitty gritty. I'm an author myself, although I only have one book under my belt, but I've edited other books and whatnot. What's the split with the author? How does that work?
So the author rates would be, royalty rates would be very familiar to you if you had published with any other publisher. So, and how does that work at our lower price point? It's relatively straightforward. So instead of having kind of sell through of new books in the teens, which is where the industry is now, the author therefore doesn't participate in any of those kind of any of that used market. They don't get any royalties from that. Our sell through is at the other end of the scale, because if your book starts at $29.95, I mean, that's the price of a pizza, right? Maybe two pizzas. And so what we find is, you know, the calculus that a student goes through is, do I need a book for this class, or can I get away without one? And if I need a book, what is the least expensive version that I can use? And therefore, they will go to used, they will go to rental, they will go to everything. And only when those supplies are exhausted will they buy a new book at $300, right? When it's $29.95, that changes completely. And if you think about what is the essence of a textbook is there to leverage the instructor, right? We're very sort of instructor-centric, because you know, they're going to be at the center of the learning process for the foreseeable future as far as we're concerned. And a textbook's designed to leverage their time and expertise. Well, that breaks down if nobody has the right book in front of them. The author will participate, if you think about it, in revenue against, you know, let's say it's 80-90% of students who buy a book from us versus teens. So even at a lower price point, you know, those numbers largely stack up. The other thing that we offer our authors is growth, right? If you are one of a number of econ professors, let's say, you know, publishing, let's say you're publishing at Cengage. Well, you know, everybody knows Greg Mankiw's got the leading title there. So if you are number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on down to 12 publishing econ, you're not seeing a lot of growth. And I think we all know that share shift in the industry is really, really slow, because professors haven't had a big reason. They certainly haven't had price as a reason to shift from one publisher to the other, one title to another. And so we can offer similar levels of kind of revenue per classroom, if you will, similar royalty rates, but growth as well. And that's an attractive proposition for an author.
I see. One of my areas of interest too, of course, is the learning management system. And a lot of faculty provide their own content. They upload their own content. Sometimes they, you know, there's a plugin for a publisher, a link to some online components. Is this something that you offer as well?
Yeah, we try and play nice with, you know, the four largest LMSs. So with Blackboard, Canvas, D2L, Brightspace, and Moodle. We just actually launched a homework solution, because when we acquired Flatworld, there wasn't one. So we went out, and it's powered by Learnosity, but we built a homework solution that was designed to be really, really easy. You didn't need lots of sort of tutoring and experts and tech support and so on to use that. And that, again, integrates fully with those four LMS formats. And so we do that. And then we have some kind of larger deals where we sort of plug in slightly different sort of flavors and ways. But yes, we try and be LMS friendly, because a lot of schools find that's an easier way of, you know, of delivering content.
Right. Now, does it get to the level, the sort of the granular level of offering PowerPoint slides to faculty that they can pull from your books?
So we have a full suite. We have PowerPoint slides, we have instructor manuals, we have quizzing, flashcards, we have test banks, the full suite. And that's one of the big differentiators from OER. I mean, what we found is a lot of people have tried OER, and they said it's great, but it's missing all of these other things, which basically create a lot of extra work for us. Mm-hmm. And so I think there'll always be a market for OER, but I think it combination of having difficulty finding a sustainable revenue model, plus in many instances having some deficiencies in terms of that full suite of tools, you know, makes it less viable for certain schools and professors. And so, yeah, that's an important component of what we offer, all within that same price. The homework, for example, $29.95, it comes with homework. We don't go and charge another $100 for homework.
It sounds pretty reasonable. So in the whole realm, I guess, of textbooks, you've got the traditional textbooks and the publishers on one end, you've got open education resources on the other, and you're in the middle. How would you compare those three areas of the market in terms of?
Well, I would say, yeah, we're in the middle. We're certainly not in the middle in terms of price. If you think of the market, I mean, the market in North America, it's about a $4 billion market, right? And that is it's dominated by the very large publishers, by Cengage and Pearson, Wiley, Macmillan, McGraw, right? Those guys have sort of got it sewn up. It's an oligopoly in sort of economist terms. You have OER. Now, funny enough, it's hard to sort of understand what their market share is on a dollar basis to do comparison, because actually if you take our online $29.95 and then our print at $25 on top of that, actually I looked at one of the OpenStax books the other day. Their online is free, but their print is about $55, so you end up coming out about the same sort of price. But if you look at it in terms of adoption share, we've still got an awfully long way to go. I mean, we're growing rapidly. We've got about, last season we had about 4,000 professors using Flat World. That's going to grow very substantially because we have 20 field-based sales reps this year, and actually we're going to add another 30. So we're getting a lot of traction, but still a small part of the overall universe. And I don't know where OER is. I mean, there are some wins. We've certainly had some wins from former OER users, but, there will always be an OER component, I'm sure.
It's a nice place to be in that you have a lot of room for growth, it looks like.
Well, we do, and I think we have this tailwind of the whole affordability. People are fed up with, you hear about it, I'm sure, the whole time, and they are looking for an alternative that isn't compromised in some shape or form. So, that's what we're aiming for.
Was looking at your website, I ran across the phrase inclusive access.
Yeah.
Can you tell my audience what that refers to and how that relates to your offering?
Yeah, so we have a product called Flat World Unlimited, which is, I'm sure our marketing people wouldn't like me to describe it this way, but it's kind of all you can eat. So we'll sell that at the school level, and we'll say sort of have at it. We'll agree a price and say, and we'll fix that for a number of years, and we'll say have at it. You'll get access to all of our titles, we're not trying to. First of all, we don't have an extensive enough list to say, you just should go exclusively with us. I think our motivation is a little bit different. I mean, there's a lot of talk about inclusive access deals, and I think anytime a publisher is pushing something really hard and getting excited about it, I think you got to sit up and say, okay, well, why are they so excited about it? Where's the cash, right? you read about some of these schools who are saying, okay, well, we're bundling this in with our overall sort of tuition cost, we're billing it back to the students, and that's a wonderful thing. But I think that they should negotiate a lot harder than they do, because, I was reading one article the other day, and I think it was on Inside Higher Ed, actually, and a school was saying that they'd saved an awful lot of money. What they'd done is they'd taken the list price for the book and they divided it in two because they recognized that some people buy used. And then they'd compared that price with the price that they were paying per student for inclusive access. And they thought they were getting a really good deal. Well, they weren't. If 15% or 20% of students only buy new, you should be dividing that by five, right? Not just dividing in two. And so they were flattering the discount that they were actually getting off a very high list price. And there's a lot of talk about everybody having materials on the first day of class and so on. For us, actually, for all our books, any student, whether the professor's adopted or not, they get the first three chapters free online. Because we recognize students will start a class and maybe they'll drop out, or maybe they want to try the book, they don't know if they need it or whatever. So let them have it for free to get a taste for it and then decide if they need it or not. So materials on the first day of class has never been an impediment.
That's a real nice feature. Yeah, that's very clever.
Yeah. So that's our Flat World Unlimited. And, it doesn't work for everybody, but actually we've got some traction with some schools who find that, again, when a professor's not sort of forced to use our book, if they have it there available, they can try it. They may want to try it alongside an existing text, decide if they like it, and then, hopefully they do. Hopefully they get value from it. And then, in 3 years' time, we come back and we can look and say, how much have you used it? How much value have you got? We can sort of renew and hopefully we can strike another fair deal.
Sounds good. Listen, I want to be respectful of your time, and I just want to give you one more opportunity to let us know about anything new, anything that we haven't covered yet that you think would be important to get across.
Well, I think it is. I mean, the first thing we're trying to do is get the word out about Flat World. So not everybody's heard of us. In fact, a lot of people haven't heard about us. So, and we're used across the board. We've got a lot of schools that people heard, you know, Ohio State and Berkeley and Stanford and PU and MIT, all these wonderful schools. But we have a lot of smaller schools are using us. And again, I told you I just commissioned some work that we did directly surveying our professors. And I've been in this industry a long time. It's been a long time since I've seen satisfaction levels this high amongst adopting professors. And we did one with students a few months ago. That was really positive as well. So people are sticking with it once they adopt it, and they really like the product. And so we hope to get the word out to more folks, and you know, we hope to continue to develop and continue to grow.
Sounds good. Well, I will certainly try to spread the word here, and best of luck in your venture here. It seems like you're off to a great start.
I hope we are, and really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Sure thing. Thanks, Alistair.
Okay, all the best.
Well, the publishing business is an interesting one. It certainly changed a lot in the past decade because of all the electronic ways of distributing textbooks. So I think it's worthwhile to take a look at their catalog and see if they can benefit you and your institution. So don't forget to stay tuned for the full song, Mine Again by Black Lab. Till next time, have a great week.
I used to go. There's a world I used to know. There was a light and it was you. Every word I say.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog or send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.